Today's episode is a lengthy one, or lengthier, which is fitting since I've made you wait so long for it. This is one of those shows where I got done with the research months ago. And as I assembled it and wrote out various observations and thoughts, wrapped up my research, it got to the point where my conclusions and the direction that the episode was heading was making me increasingly, let's say, uncomfortable. It didn't feel like I had really wrapped my head around what I wanted to say about this passage that we're doing today. I just had a lot of really interesting questions that were lingering out there without much resolution. And some of the conclusions I was coming to, I wasn't so sure about. So I thought about just abandoning the whole topic, just scrapping the research, moving on to the next thing. Instead, and I'm happy I didn't scrap this one, I decided to rethink my approach based on the research that I compiled, and I am very confident that the end result that you're now listening to and about to listen to is just far and away superior to the previous version. But I thought I should explain the lack of a longer podcast episode for so long. Today's topic is Joseph. Specifically the scene in Genesis chapter 39 where Joseph is a slave in an Egyptian official's house. This official's name is Potiphar. And Joseph, in the course of the story, is propositioned repeatedly by Potiphar's wife. Joseph resists, but then is falsely accused by the wife. And by the end of the chapter, we find Joseph in the Egyptian royal prison. So as fair warning, if stories of adultery or attempted adultery or bad behavior on the part of women and men aren't in your desired repertoire this particular day, you could always give this episode a pass until a later time. Of course, you are going to have a tough time reading your Old Testament with those kinds of self-imposed restrictions.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
I chose this passage because there's a number of things just fascinate me about it. First of all, there's the element of the seduction by Joseph's master's wife. Potiphar's wife. And I was curious to find, through the course of my research, if there were other examples in ancient Near Eastern text or Egyptian text or Babylonian text, maybe, of other similar accounts. Was this a common theme? Was this a common motif? Was this a common story that people were telling? Was there sort of a common thread where this story would kind of get repackaged and retold over the centuries? And it turns out that's exactly the case. There are plenty, numerous examples of seductions and failed seductions and successful seductions on the behalf of men and women, by the way. It wasn't always females seducing men. It was, I don't want to say just as often, but we have plenty of examples of it being the other way around too. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on that specifically today. I think it's enough to say that there are plenty of examples. This account in Genesis 39 is not a unique one. It's not a unique one in terms of plot. I'm going to argue it's very unique in terms of what it's trying to say, the deeper message. But this element of seduction and adultery is an incredibly common theme in ancient times and, of course, modern. It's interesting, though, this was another question that kind of got me onto this topic. It's interesting that we boil the story down to lust. There's Joseph's potential lust with Potiphar's wife. There's the obvious lust that Potiphar's wife has towards Joseph. But it's interesting to me that we can boil this story down to a simple morality tale, a story of virtue and character only. And I absolutely love digging into passages that have been oversimplified, and I love presenting those to you. I wish I had quite the skill of a Malcolm Gladwell to take something that we've all accepted as true and to turn it on its head. This episode isn't going to go quite that far. It is a story about lust, and it is a story about adultery, or attempted adultery. That is the surface plot, but there are layers upon layers upon layers of other, more compelling elements to this story. And then there's this one of those elements, and perhaps the key one, being that the Joseph narrative as a whole, the entire story of Joseph's life, which takes up a good chunk of the book of Genesis, is actually part of this larger national conversation about Israelite identity that is happening throughout the Old Testament and into then the New Testament with many of Paul's writings. Who are we? What is our relationship to our God? What does it mean to live in a community of believers? What does it mean to be separated from that community? So, as I mentioned, seduction is a common ancient Near Eastern theme. It's a common Egyptian theme. It's a common theme today. But I wanted to read to you something. It's maybe just an example out of Proverbs chapter 7, an ancient Near Eastern biblical caution. And in this case, it's a caution against a man being pulled into seduction, allowing himself to be lured by seduction. And this is what many people will quote when they talk about this story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife. So Proverbs 7, quote, "Let not your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her path. For many a victim has she laid low. Yes, all of her slain are a mighty host. Her house is the way to Sheol, going down to the chambers of death." And that's end quote. That's fantastic, isn't it? "Her house is the way to hell." It's great. We also have Paul's words in Romans 13, quote, "Make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires," end quote. I don't think anyone's ever accused Paul of being a free spirit. Both Proverbs and Romans seem to be warning, right, against the opportunity to fall into sin. Don't stray into her path. Don't walk down the road where you know temptation is crouching, eagerly waiting for you. There are also multiple cautions to women about falling into the snares of seductive men, and we see this again throughout the ancient Near East. But is that really what this scene in Joseph's life is about? A failed seduction. Resisting the temptation of openly available illicit sex. Since, as we'll read in the Joseph account, he does in fact resist the wife's sexual advances. And because of this, pastors will use the story of Joseph over and over and over to illustrate the victorious life against temptation and sin. "Thus go ye, young man," young woman. Youth group leaders will hold Joseph up as an example of biblical virtue and sexual purity in adolescence. "Be like Joseph, not like all your friends." There's something off-putting to me about that, about this simply boiling down to a morality tale, about some vague example of how to conduct ourselves sexually. Strength of character and faith winning out over lust. It is about that. But if that's all it's about, it's not particularly compelling, is it? Well, it's not to me. But as with the narratives in other parts of the Old Testament, there are undercurrents of meaning below the surface of this story. So I would like for us to spend some time today fleshing out those undercurrents. It's a story about free versus slave, refugee versus homeland, and the faithfulness of Israel's God versus the outward experience of desperate circumstances, power versus powerlessness, and how powerlessness can actually be deceptively powerful. So for the benefit of those of us who may need a refresher on Joseph's life, or who have maybe never heard it or been very familiar with the Joseph account in the book of Genesis, I thought I would just quickly recap where we're at in this point of the Joseph story. So we're going to start at the beginning of it and just summarize very quickly. So Joseph is an Israelite, and he is born to Jacob and his wife Rachel. And there's a whole backstory to them earlier in the book of Genesis, and we don't really have time to go into that. Joseph is born to Jacob and Rachel. And it sounds simple enough, until we realize that Jacob, there's that backstory, Jacob actually had children by at least three different women. Leah, Rachel, Bilhah, Zilpha are the four that we know about. And this was not anything scandalous or uncommon for the time, right? For that culture. But there are all kinds of shady arrangements that lead to this large family coming onto the scene. And Joseph's older brothers and sister get into all kinds of trouble earlier on in Genesis. But Joseph's story really takes off in Genesis 37, chapter 37. And I want to read the beginning of the story to you, because it's so important in sort of pulling back that curtain of what Joseph's temptation many years later is really all about. So chapter 37, verse 1. Quote, "Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojourning, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel," that's another name for Jacob, by the way, "now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children." End quote. It's crucial to note that the name Israel is another name for Jacob, Joseph's father. It's where the name comes from. Is it significant that the story of the history of Israel immediately begins with the story of Israel's offspring, of Joseph? Of course it is. Because who's this being written down for? Well, originally it was written down, the book of Genesis, the Old Testament, it was written down for the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, the descendants of Israel. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. We call these books of the Bible the Hexateuch, which means six. It's being written as the prehistory of the nation of Israel. These books are also the prehistory of the worship and faith of this God who is named Yahweh. And Yahweh is the deity which creates and presides over the Hebrew people. Yahweh is the deity of the Old and New Testaments. Joseph is here partly to connect the original readership to the narrative. Who is Joseph? Well, we are Joseph. The Israelite people are Joseph. What is Joseph? He's loved. God is with Joseph. That means God is with us. Pretty cool, huh? Back to Joseph. There's some favoritism going on here, right? The father loves him more than the other children. This does not go over well, and we are told in the text that his other brothers come to hate him. So not great for Joseph. And then one night he has this dream. And in this dream, he and his brothers are gathering up wheat in the fields. And his bundle of wheat proceeds to stand up while the bundles of all the brothers bow down low in front of his. Symbolism. Whatever the equivalent of second millennium BC street smarts was, Joseph didn't have it, because he immediately goes and tells his brothers about this dream. "Oh, really?" they reply. "So you're going to rule over us, huh? You're going to be our king? Is that what you're saying?" No kidding. So they're not happy. In the course of this, Joseph has a second dream. "Hey, look, I dreamed another dream. Look at this. The sun, moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Of course, he has 12 brothers. "Sun, moon, and 11 stars are bowing down to me. This is my dream." So one day soon after, Joseph goes looking for his brothers while they're working in the fields. Interesting that he was not with his other brothers. Quote, "So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. And they saw him from afar off. And before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, 'Here comes that dreamer. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of these pits. And we'll say that a wild beast has devoured him, and then we'll see what becomes of his dreams.'" End quote. So his brother Reuben isn't on board with this plan, and he convinces his brothers instead to throw Joseph into the pit without hurting him, so secretly he can come back later and rescue him. Reuben has a soft spot for his brother. Ultimately, Joseph is betrayed by his brothers, tossed into the well.
Rough night, huh? Well, it's about to get a lot rougher.
Apparently, at some point, Reuben is out of the scene, off getting water, or who knows. And some merchants come by. This would be a traveling caravan on their way to Egypt. And this particular part of the story is really about the heartbreaking part, if we read between the lines. We're told that some of the brothers have sat down to eat, while Joseph is at the bottom of the well. How long has he been down there? An hour? A couple? Well, the text doesn't say, but what is Joseph saying to them? Is he pleading? Crying? Is he angry? We have no idea. It's not recorded. But as these merchants come by on their camels, Judah, one of the other brothers, gets the idea to sell Joseph to this caravan. And the brothers that are there with him agree. This isn't a game. Like, they're serious. They want this guy gone. They can't kill him. They want to get rid of him. So do these brothers' actions reflect ancient Near Eastern realities? Absolutely. So, you know, I can't imagine one brother being betrayed by his siblings like this. Well, in the ancient Near East, you can completely believe it. This is a big family. Four wives, children by four different women, at least. And the power in the family is supposed to proceed in a fairly predictable fashion. Joshua, being one of the youngest sons of the family, realistically, does not have much of a claim to the headship of the family when Jacob dies. But contrary to that expectation, not only is Jacob showing blatant favoritism towards this young son over the other brothers, but now, what's Joseph doing? He's all but admitting to his aspirations of power over the household by his dreams, and by him telling his brothers about these dreams. It's being interpreted by his brothers as, "I want the power of the house. I want to rule over you." You might remember the story of a man named Abimelech, and this would be in the book of Judges. He executes a power play to rule the Canaanite city of Shechem. And by doing this, what he does is he succeeds by executing 70 of his brothers, who he viewed as competition, obviously. So we have other examples of this. Most of Joseph's brothers aren't just jealous of him, but now they're also deeply suspicious of him. What's his motivation? It's only a matter of time until Jacob dies, and if Joseph grabs that power for himself, as he's all but admitted that he wants to do, well, what happens to them? They feel threatened by him every much as they feel jealous of him. So Reuben returns to this well sometime later. His plan to rescue their brother has backfired. Joseph's gone. His response is one of surprised, anguished grief. And regardless of how your English translation has rendered it, in the original Hebrew, it comes out as incomprehensible gibberish, which is wonderful to read. Some humor in the text, some humor in the middle of a dark story. And even if you don't know a word of Hebrew, you can pick it out just by listening to the transliteration. Let me just do that for you now. In Hebrew, this is what the brother Reuben says when he discovers that Joseph is gone. He's not in the well. He says, "Hayeled elenenu va'ani ana aniba." It's gibberish. If you were to translate it literally, the boy is not. And where can I go? It doesn't mean anything. He's stunned. And his plan to rescue his brother has failed. So now the brothers have to return to their father Jacob, which maybe they haven't thought this all the way through. They have to return to their father Jacob, but without Joseph. Okay, so how to handle this? Well, they take Joseph's robe, and which their father had given him, and they slather it in goat's blood. And then they show it to their father. "Hey, so we found this." Cough. And that's it. Hoping to pass the goat's blood as Joseph's, of course. The sense that you get from the text is they're not anxious to incriminate themselves by saying too much. And one has to wonder how much faith they really have in this story of theirs. And convincing all 11 brothers to keep to the script, right? But Jacob buys it. Quote, "It is my son's robe. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." End quote.
The abbot at first tried to console Pai Mei, only to find Pai Mei was inconsolable.
And at this, Jacob is inconsolable. His many sons and daughters approach him, but he cannot be comforted. Quote, "No, I will go down to Sheol to my son, mourning." And thus his father wept for him. End quote. Effectively, "My son I will see in hell." And where is that son, really? Well, he's going to become a slave, sold into the household of Potiphar, captain of the guard of Pharaoh. Now, in the code language, in the parlance of Old Testament narrative themes, Joseph is dead. Joseph is dead. At least in a particular sense. You see, when someone goes down to Egypt, it's like going down to the abode of the dead, going down to the grave, going down to the house of slavery. Why is Egypt down? Because Israel is north of Egypt. To go from Israel to Egypt, you have to go down. After all, what's the entire book of Exodus about? The Hebrews as slaves in Egypt, the threat of death, the loss of blessing, serving in someone else's house, the disintegration of Yahweh God's promises over Israel. At least on the surface, right? Remember, the story of Joseph is the story of the Hebrew people. It's the story of God's people. Oh, Joseph is now a slave in Egypt. Well, so were we, say the Jewish and Hebrew people who would hear this story for generations to come. Joseph is going to be a slave in Egypt. And they also recall when their own people were a slave in Egypt. So the next chapter, after this story of young Joseph being tossed in a well and being recovered and sold to this caravan, the next chapter is chapter 38. And it's very strange. Scholars unanimously comment on this. It's very strange that chapter 38 does not continue Joseph's story immediately. Instead, it completely switches characters to an overview of his older brother Judah's life. And wow, is it messed up. If Joseph's story is an example of a righteous man of God behaving himself in the face of sexual temptation, Judah's story is sexual dysfunction left, right, and center. I'll leave it to you to read through Genesis 38 on your own if you'd like, but suffice it to say that the line of David, okay, this is King David, the big king, the one of the Old Testament, the greatest king Israel will ever know. But King David is the descendant of Judah, not Joseph. The Lion of Judah, as David is known. So while the Hebrew people identify with Joseph, who will be a slave in Egypt, well, now they're also forced to identify with Judah. And who is Judah? He is the father of disobedient sons. That's what Genesis 38 tells us. Someone who mistreats his son's wife and even goes so far as to sleep with her. That's Judah for you. And then he almost executes her. Okay, Israel as a people is forced to reckon with their origin and their history. The same way that Joseph is part of their story, Judah is also part of their story. Both being blameless like Joseph and being deeply dysfunctional like Judah. So in this episode, just like in Genesis, Judah is presented as an aside to the story of Joseph. But its place in the text is absolutely no mistake. Lest you, reader, the one who listens to my story, lest you consider yourself blameless and a complete victim of evil, don't forget where you come from. You are a victim of evil, but you also contain the potential to cause evil, as Judah did. It's a cautionary balance to the story of Joseph. Okay, now to Genesis chapter 39. This is the meat of today's episode. This is the story we want to get to. Genesis 39, verses 1 to 6. Well, these set the scene for us very well. And there's a significant amount of repetition in these first few verses about Yahweh's presence, Yahweh being with Joseph, blessing Joseph, traveling with Joseph, who was a slave. Remember, he was sold. He's bought by this, or brought rather, by this caravan down to Egypt. So Joseph being brought to Egypt down means he is now in negative space. This is a place where we would expect Joseph to run into difficulties, into problems, and definitely not to prosper. Things should go very poorly for Joseph here, except that we find that God, Yahweh, has traveled with Joseph to the negative space and is blessing him. Psalm 23 might come to mind. Okay, we're then told that a man named Potiphar, and this is a native Egyptian who is one of Pharaoh's chief officers. Okay, Potiphar buys Joseph and brings him into his home to be what is known as a household servant, household slave. And a household servant would actually not be in a bad position, comparatively speaking. If you had to be a slave, it was definitely better to be a household slave than, say, a slave outdoors, working in the fields, doing manual labor, corvée labor. A household slave might even be entrusted with significant responsibilities for a wealthier house, and this is exactly what we're going to see happen with Joseph. Nahum Sarna, in his Genesis commentary, points us to the ancient Egyptian document, this document known as Brooklyn 35.1446. And this document dates between 1833 to 1742 BCE, It's an Egyptian document. And why it is significant is that it contains a list of Asiatic or Semitic slaves, and it also contains a list of Egyptian slaves, which we can distinguish easily by their names. Semitic names are very different from Egyptian names. And what we consistently see through this list, in this document, is that the Semitic or Asiatic slaves seem to consistently be given higher, more prominent roles. So meanwhile, the native Egyptian slaves are given less prominent roles. They're the ones more likely to be out working in the fields. A scholar named K.A. Kitchen, in a 1956 article, was one of the first Egyptologists to examine this document. And he found that in one example of a large Egyptian household, 45 of the 79 household servants had Semitic names rather than Egyptian ones. Which, I mean, just imagine the house that needs 79 slaves to run itself, first of all. But this is probably not too far off from the image we're meant to conjure up of Potiphar's house. So, might be employing more Semitic slaves in the house. The Egyptian slaves are more likely to be doing the manual labor, maybe working in the kitchen, maybe out in the fields. So there's a little bit of racial segregation, racial disparity, even among the slaves. There are still hierarchies of social status. And that's pretty key to what's going to happen next. Okay, one thing we know about Potiphar, at least from the perspective of the one telling the story in Genesis, is that Potiphar notices that God, called by his name Yahweh throughout this chapter, God is with Joseph. And Joseph seems to be succeeding in everything he does as this privileged slave. Potiphar notices this. Verse 3 explicitly states that Potiphar sees Yahweh is with Joseph, which might seem kind of unlikely since Yahweh is not an Egyptian deity. He's unknown in Egypt as far as we know. But could Potiphar have assumed that a local Israelite deity had attached itself to Joseph and was helping him accomplish his work? Well, yeah, absolutely, of course, that would fit. So we have to be careful with this chapter's statement, I guess, that Potiphar saw that Yahweh was with Joseph. That doesn't necessarily imply that Potiphar in any way recognized the significance of Yahweh as the only Israelite deity. Thus, monotheism, which would be completely foreign to an Egyptian thought system at this time. But verses 4 to 6 show the consequence of this. Verse 6, quote, "So he, Potiphar, left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and having him, he had no concern for anything but the food which he ate," end quote. So things are going very well for Potiphar, which the biblical text attributes to Joseph being present in the household, thus Yahweh is present in the household. Which is a fascinating theology, isn't it? What would a present-day analogy be to this? Is the Bible just reflecting the ancient Semitic superstition that having a holy man present in your house brings you luck and prosperity? A living totem pole? A living idol. And we saw this belief play out in Judges chapter 17, by the way, for those longtime listeners, they might remember my Judges series. Is the text reflecting an outdated superstition? Or does the presence of certain consecrated people in the 21st century in which we now live carry with it God's presence and God's blessing? Does being in the presence of someone holy affect your life on a spiritual plane? Did you come up with an answer? Be careful. I don't think it's as obvious an answer as it might first appear. The end of verse 6 concludes with this rather ominous aside. Quote, "Now, Joseph was handsome and good-looking," end quote. What can this possibly have to do with Potiphar and Joseph? But remember, this is being recited orally. This is story time. This is an origin story to be told around the campfire. And at this comment about Joseph's prettiness, there would be smirks and knowing smiles all around, because we know that these pretty boy looks are about to get him in all kinds of trouble. I mean, don't think that some of these rabbis and storytellers, this is long before the days of rabbis, but this story is being told orally for centuries. And don't think that the storyteller wouldn't have all kinds of fun reciting these narratives. We don't have to imagine very hard that they're going to include the subversive humor of this text in their reenactments. Yes, this is God's word, but it's also pretty darn funny. Quote, "And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.'" End quote. So goes verse 7. Well, as they say, that escalated quickly. And what we see in Joseph's response is, no, this isn't even on the table. A total refusal of her advances. And he proceeds in verses 8, 9, and 10 to lay out this very logical, very reasonable and concise rationale for his refusal. "Allow me to lay out the case, dear madam." Which I happen to think could also be quite humorous if read or enacted in the right way by the storyteller. Here is this woman with great power, the wife of his slave master, propositioning him. And Joseph thinks, oh, a point-by-point rebuttal of each of her points is going to keep her at a distance. He even accommodates her Egyptian polytheism, her belief in many gods. He incorporates this into his argument. Verse 9, he says, How could I do this great evil and sin against God? And that word God being the Hebrew term Elohim, this is a generic Semitic word for God or gods. It can be singular or plural. He doesn't appeal to the wife's belief and obligations to Yahweh, the Israelite God, because she has no such obligation. He appeals instead to her general obligation against all the gods. This would be an offense to all of the gods. Surely she'll understand that, of course, right? Does this work on Joseph's behalf? No. No. Spectacularly no. She repeatedly tries to seduce him after this. And we learn that Joseph is trying his best to freeze this woman out. He won't be around her. He tries not to listen to her. Probably a little difficult, seeing as she's the wife of the man that owns him, but whatever, right? But if this is one of those households with dozens of servants, as it undoubtedly is, and Joseph is stuck managing all these people, it's fair to assume that he and Potiphar's wife, who's never actually given a name in the text, by the way, and don't think that's not significant, he and Potiphar's wife are never actually left alone. There are so many people. They're never actually left alone until one day she finds him alone and pounces. "For shame, Mrs. Robinson. Mrs. Potiphar." And she grabs tightly onto his clothing. And the Hebrew is very generic here. It's maybe a cloak, maybe just a shirt, could be about anything. But she grabs onto it, and he manages to slip out of whatever it is he's wearing and bursts outside in a rush. This guy seriously is not into the situation playing out, is he? And now I want to read you verbatim what she is quoted as saying and doing in the text, starting in verse 13. Quote, "When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, 'Look here, he has brought a Hebrew man into our midst to make fun of us. He came to me to lie with me, and so I called out, screaming. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his clothes beside me and fled outside.'" End quote. Who is she talking to here? Well, the men of the household, it says. But most likely her Egyptian servants. Because notice the language that she uses. Potiphar brought us, this Hebrew man, to make fun of us. And presumably there is quite some friction between the native Egyptian servants and the Semitic servants. And she's going to play on this racial, ethnic, religious friction. Aren't you glad that no one tries that today, right? To highlight differences and to use them for their own political advantage. Cough. But she's the offender here. And she twists it. So Joseph is the offender. The foreign man who was brought in and made the boss over all of us. Oh, boo, we hate him. We're all in this together after all, and this affects all of us. Be outraged. Never mind that the person saying this to them is the boss's wife, and they're bought and paid for slaves. She gets even craftier, though, Mrs. Potiphar, as she tries to navigate her way out of this situation. The text says that she keeps Joseph's clothes near her, conveniently, until Potiphar returns from his official duties, at which point she ambushes him. How was your day, honey? Quote, "The Hebrew slave who you brought to us came to me to make fun of me, and when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his clothes beside me and escaped outside." End quote. And I want to read the next part verbatim as well. But I want us to concentrate on the specific words that are used to describe Potiphar's reaction to this news. And did you notice how she phrased the story? "The Hebrew slave who you brought to us came to make fun of me." And now it's not just Joseph's fault, but mainly she says, it's your fault. It's your Potiphar's fault. You brought this guy to us. I didn't want him. Look what he did. And here is Potiphar's response. Quote, "Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, 'This is what your slave did to me,' his anger burned." End quote. His anger burned against who? Isn't it interesting that the text refuses to say? There's no object. His anger burned. So who is he angry with? Joseph? Exactly wrong. Exactly wrong. He's angry with his wife, not Joseph. Listen to her language. She just accused him. She's jabbing her finger into his chest. "Look what your slave did!" Does he know that she's lying? What do you think? So who is Potiphar again? Well, he's the captain of the guard of the Egyptian pharaoh. This is a prominent position, and likely one of his duties would be to administer and supervise the royal prison. So says Bill Arnold in his Genesis commentary, and I tend to agree. Both from an Egyptian historical perspective as well as the language of the biblical text, both seem to support this. If Potiphar doubts Joseph's guilt, he can't very well leave him a free man without consequences. See, his wife was smart, and she got the other slaves to rally to her side in all this. So they're all going to wonder, why does this Hebrew get off free after trying it on with the missus? Are you kidding me? So Potiphar's in a bad position now. The court of public opinion, even though the public opinion he owns, it's still public opinion, and there's still dozens of them and one of him. He's in a bad position. And Joseph's been running his whole household, remember? Joseph is the administrative head of this massive organization that is his house. So at this point of our analysis, it is easy to vilify his wife. And the text certainly seems to take that approach. Here she is, she acted out of uncontrolled lust. And then covered up her actions when things went south. And all of this is true according to the text. But as with so much of the biblical text, there is much more going on. And so I want us to try and get inside the head of Mrs. Potiphar. And we'll do that here in a second. But Potiphar's solution is to place Joseph in the royal prison. And that seems bad, and yeah, it's not great. But he's not sold. He's not sold to someone else. Remember, Joseph's just cattle. Joseph's just property as far as the law is concerned. That's all he is. So he's not sold. He's not beheaded. He's not, sewn into a sack and tossed into the Nile. All of these things we have records from Egypt as happening commonly with offenses like this. How does the chapter end? Well, the same way it began. Yahweh is with Joseph, and the chief jailer eventually is impressed enough with Joseph to put him in charge of the rest of the prisoners. And again, we're told that the chief jailer's life now dramatically improves because Joseph and his God Yahweh are there in the jail. Where Joseph goes, Yahweh follows. So that's the narrative. That's the meat of the story. But let's get to a bit of the post-game analysis, because I think that's where the meaning and the really compelling parts of the story get brought out. And one of the first things that really seems to give analysts pause in this account is the fact that Joseph is never remotely tempted in the story to cave. Is this reasonable? Is it believable? He pushes Potiphar's wife away, seemingly at every opportunity, and never once thinks to give in to her. The reasons he gives are all good, noble, pure reasons. We mustn't offend God after all. Okay, but remember, Joseph's a teenager. Almost certainly a virgin at this point. And he's being propositioned hard. So through the centuries, these facts alone have proven to be problematic for many. Is this really believable that he would turn down such a available opportunity? Shimon Bakon has an interesting piece where he lays out the case for Joseph's refusal actually being laced with hesitations rather than certainty. And he cites as part of his argument the Jewish Talmud. And the Jewish Talmud being a collection of documents between the first, or for the last couple centuries BC, the first couple centuries CE, these documents of Jewish origin interpreting and adding commentary to the Old Testament. So Shimon Bakon quotes part of the Talmud to support his case that Joseph was probably much more hesitant to turn down Potiphar's wife than the text in Genesis makes it appear. And in particular, we're going to quote from the Talmud Sota 36b, and this would date from the first couple centuries CE. And let me just read for you that portion of interest from the Jewish Talmud. It's very interesting. Quote, "As it is written, and it came to pass about this time that he went into the house to do his work. Rabbi Johanan has said, this teaches that both Joseph and Potiphar's wife had the intention of acting immorally. Rav and Samuel differ in their interpretations. One says that it really means to do his work, but the other has said that he went in to satisfy his desires. And there was none of the men in the house? It is possible that there was no man in a huge house like that of the wicked Potiphar? What was taught in the school of Rabbi Ishmael? That day was their feast day, and they had all gone to their idolatrous temple. But she had pretended to be ill, because she thought, I shall not have an opportunity like today for Joseph to associate with me. And she caught him by his garment. At that moment, his father's image came and appeared to him through the window. At that, his passion subsided, and the arms of his hands were made active. He struck his hands on the ground so that his lust came out from between his fingernails. End quote. So we see through the Talmud that various rabbis were wrestling with this idea. How was it that Joseph wasn't caught up by the same lust that caught up Potiphar's wife? And essentially they're saying that he was. And he intended to sleep with her, in fact. But, of course, just in time, Joseph sees a vision of his father Jacob. Miraculous apparition. And this is enough to strengthen his resolve and to run away. Now, I was leading a study on this passage a couple months ago. And at this point in our study, I had pointed out that the Quran, like the Talmud, contains a passage which attempts to interpret the scene in Genesis between Joseph and the wife. And that observation went over like a Led Zeppelin. I think even the crickets chirping in the distance were uncomfortable with that silence. Maybe you can imagine the frosty reception that such a suggestion received, quoting the Quran in a Bible study. Oh my, but I have faith in you, my faithful and erudite listeners, that you won't perhaps be quite so frosty if I choose now to read a small section of the Quran to you that deals with this exact topic, will you? Will you indulge me? And if this is just grossly offensive, well, hey, I'm a podcast, and you can mute me or skip past this part. The magic of technology. If you're up for it, here's the reading from the Surah of Joseph from the Quran. This is Surah 12. Quote, "The lady of the house where he lived tried to seduce him. She closed the doors and said, 'I am all yours.' He said, 'May God protect me. He is my Lord who gave me a good home. The transgressors never succeed.' She almost succumbed to him, and he almost succumbed to her, if it were not that he saw a proof from his Lord. We thus diverted evil and sin away from him, for he was one of our devoted servants. The two of them raced towards the door, and in the process she tore his garment from the back. They found her husband at the door. She said, 'What should be the punishment for one who wanted to molest your wife except imprisonment or a painful punishment?' And he said, 'She is the one who tried to seduce me.' Well, a witness from her family suggested, 'If his garment is torn from the front, then she is telling the truth and a liar. And if his garment is torn from the back, then she lied, and he is telling the truth.' So when her husband saw that his garment was torn from the back, he said, 'This is a woman's scheme. Indeed, your scheming is formidable.'" End quote. So I'm not usually the first person to issue cries of misogyny when reading a religious text, partly because our modern standards of misogyny and misandry are not even in the same ballpark as those standards during the composition of either Genesis or the Surah of the Quran. Partly because some parts, not all, but some parts of Scripture that read on the surface as misogynistic are actually satirizing male power structures, speaking satirical truth to power. But that is a different podcast. That is a different episode. In this case, quoting from the Quran, you know, it's hard to come back from, this is a woman's scheme. It's hard to come back from that. Except that it does highlight correctly, I think, the interpretation that Potiphar never bought into his wife's story. And she's causing all kinds of trouble for him in this chapter by framing his top administrator. As Bill Arnold correctly says, Potiphar's problem is not Joseph, but his own wife. And in this case, that is absolutely true. I promised we would dive into Potiphar's wife and into her motivations and into her head a bit more. And I want to do that because she can seem like a stock character in the story. The seductress. The adulteress. What I think, and what a lot of other smart people think, is that her lack of depth is actually by design and is a front. In fact, she has all kinds of depth. And that Genesis actually is showing us the dark side of oppressive power structures through her actions. Yeah, I know, mind blown, right? So here's what might be going on with her. First off, Heather McKay has postulated that Potiphar was likely a eunuch. So you know what that means. He was castrated in some fashion, either partially or fully. And she bases this on his high position within Pharaoh's administration. And it's not definite. But there is a basis in Egyptian literature and archaeological finds to warrant this possibility. And McKay is actually following a very long line of interpreters that have seen Potiphar as a eunuch. And of course, this idea enjoys plenty of controversy, like most things scholarly. But what implications would this have for his wife? See, he might well be expected to marry and to keep a household, even being a eunuch. But of course, that would come without the intimacy and sexual reinforcement of being a married couple. So let's think about that. I mean, how many years has Potiphar's wife endured this complete lack of ability by her husband to reciprocate anything intimate? See, the text mentions that Joseph is easy on the eyes. The text mentions that she desires him. But does her desire perhaps transcend simple lust? If we consider the man she's married to is incapable of having intercourse with her. It doesn't excuse her behavior, but does it at least provide her with an understandable motive? Now, Potiphar's wife would be the natural person to be entrusted with the smooth running of the household at this strata of Egyptian royal court. So while Potiphar's away attending to his business, his wife would be the ultimate authority over these dozens of slaves working in the house. Okay, but something happens when Joseph shows up. Potiphar recognizes his abilities and proficiencies, and he starts to entrust him with more and more responsibility. Okay, so what was the corollary to that? Well, his wife starts losing more and more responsibility to Joseph. And why is she never given a name? I mean, women are named throughout the Old Testament, whether their part in the story is large or small. Why is she never named? Well, I think we are meant to notice the omission. Her lack of name is synonymous with her lack of authority. It's synonymous with her lack of power. Even the power that she should have has been steadily given over to a foreign slave. Imagine the insult. A foreign slave living under her own roof, who she is powerless to control because he's the husband's favorite. So her lust, which is present, but it's augmented heavily by this power play to lessen or eliminate Joseph's authority so that she might regain her prominence in some way. Now, we could speculate that Potiphar doesn't trust his wife to run his household, even without Joseph. And look, we see some of why that might be with her actions against Joseph, her accusations against her husband, her attempts to gain favor with the Egyptian slaves in her house, to rally them against the Semitic slaves, in fact, causing an uprising in her own house. But her motivations for doing all this become clearer, don't they? And finally, what would have been the standard treatment for Potiphar's wife and Joseph? Potiphar has this accusation leveled against Joseph. Okay. Well, what are his options? Penina Galpes-Feller points out that Babylonian law of this time period would have left the decision on how to punish Joseph or his wife up to Potiphar as the husband. He is the ultimate decider. And the Egyptian sources focus much more on case studies rather than prescriptive law. You know, here's a story about so-and-so caught his wife cheating. This is what he did. The gods were happy or angered with this decision, etc. But it's clear in the Egyptian context, Potiphar probably had the choice. There's this, frankly, I mean, you might think it's heretical for me to say this, hopefully not, but there is a frankly bizarre section in Numbers chapter 5. Numbers chapter 5, verses 12 to 31. If you ever look it up, it's in effect a test, a litmus test, a ritual to determine if one's wife has committed adultery against him or not. Go read it. It reads very similar to the much later medieval period. Their trials of ordeal. These trials that people would go through to determine their guilt or innocence.
What?
There are ways of telling whether she is a witch. Tell me, what do you do with witches? And what do you burn apart from witches?
For witches!
But here the wife has already told her part of the story. So what are Potiphar's options? Imprisonment for any offense is basically unheard of in the Semitic ancient Near Eastern world that Israel comes from, that the Old Testament comes from. But there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the Egyptians resorted to jail terms as kind of standard. And that speaks to the story's authenticity, doesn't it? That Joseph would find himself in an Egyptian jail is very believable for this time period. Whereas a jail sentence in Canaan would be very suspicious in the text. So Potiphar could have executed Joseph on the spot. Could have used him as an example to their slaves. And think about it, if he really believed that Joseph was guilty of propositioning his wife, wouldn't he do exactly this? Public, gruesome execution for all the slaves of his house to witness. And boy, that would put an end to that kind of nonsense. But that's not at all what he does. Because, I would say, he doesn't believe a lick of this story his wife has told him. But he does have to take action. He can't ignore this accusation and risk a revolt among his Egyptian slaves. So he takes the path of compromise, relegating Joseph to the royal prison, where he soon begins to gain at least a shade of his former prominence. So what shades of meaning does this story contain then? For an Israelite audience retelling the story in the face of Canaanite, Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian political and military pressures as they lived through the days of the Old Testament in the first millennium BCE. Well, they would undoubtedly wish to identify with Joseph, blessed by Yahweh God, but enduring difficult circumstances, persevering with faithfulness and character when the alternative would be easier. What does the story mean in the context of the political exiles of the 6th, 5th, and 4th centuries BCE, when the people of Judah are serving as slaves in Babylon? The overriding question of that time was, how do we picture God's faithfulness in the midst of slavery, in the midst of being playthings at the whims of those ruling over us? Is God still present in our historical narrative when we serve in Babylonian homes, when we work in Babylonian fields, when we are forced to clean Babylonian irrigation canals, hundreds of miles from the land that God promised Abraham? Where is God when the whole story turns into a giant shit show, to put it bluntly? What does the story mean for a Jewish people under Roman occupation in the first century, as Jesus appears on the scene? What does it mean for the medieval Jewish communities scattered across Asia, Europe, parts of Africa, as they search for God's presence in a fractured faith and people. What does it mean for the Jews enduring Nazi persecutions early in the previous century? And then what does it say to the people of God today? Christians, Jews. How do we wrestle with God's faithfulness when the circumstances are this dire? When despite our best displays of character and intention, we find ourselves as chess pieces in other people's political and personal power plays. Hyun-Kul Paul Kim summarizes it this way. Quote, like the rest of the book of Genesis, and possibly the entire Pentateuch, the Joseph story depicts complex themes of a champion among the underdogs and the heroics of the outsider. It signals indomitable human faith in a mysterious divine chesed in the face of exilic and post-exilic turmoil. Put another way, in the story of the diaspora communities, Joseph portrays a model life amid the socio-political, ethnic, and economic struggles and tensions between the insiders and the outsiders, between the powerful and marginalized. End quote. So is this part of the Joseph story about lust? Yes. But it is also a vehicle for discussions of God's faithfulness. Can this God actually be counted on? Is there a behind-the-scenes faithfulness to God's action in our lives when the outward circumstances are desperate? Is there a power to our outward powerlessness? Are we simply being batted around the scenes of our lives as others more powerful jostle for position? Or is this pinball-esque existence undergirded by an organized intelligence which is positioning us to be powerful in unexpected and subversive ways? This and these questions are also the message of Joseph's encounter with Potiphar's wife. But seriously, guys and gals, lust is wrong, okay?